Chapter 43 The Siege of Castle Cambrian. Her name was Lenadara of Westwood, called Dara by her father, my yeoman, Cayman of Westwood, and she was 13 years old. The young woman had bright red hair, a constellation of freckles across her cute button nose, and a receded chin and overbite that was as adorable as it was awkward. How had she defeated the long list of challenges we had prepared for the trials? Simple. She had used her hawk to fetch it. Not a normal hawk. It was one of the great hooded silver raptors that enjoyed nesting in nearly impossible-to-get-to remote mountain peaks. She had gone out in search of it in the rough country beyond the high ridge to the west, just before we had ridden into Sevendor last year, and she had been patiently training it ever since. That wasn't unusual. Hawking was a popular sport among the nobility, and the Westwood men had trained hawks in the past. Dara had learned much of what she knew about the art from her uncle Kerim, but she had schooled her bird not just in hunting. Lenadara of Westwood had enough talent and intuition to learn how to transfer her consciousness into the bird as it flew, seeing with its eyes and directing its actions with her mind. It was the most natural kind of magic. She hadn't even realized she was doing it until she had directed the bird to attack a tree fox that had gotten into the chicken coop, and she saw the egg-stealing beast through the eyes of her bird for the first time. While it had scared her, Dara was brave, brave enough to scale a 40-foot cliff to retrieve her bird, named Frightful, in the first place. After that first time, she had been stealthily practicing with Frightful, ostensibly as a hunter, but in reality as her animal familiar. Not all magi have familiars, although many spellmongers, hedge magi, and village witches favor them. While I have a great and abiding affection for my horse, Traveler, it doesn't even approach the same relationship as I would have with a familiar. Personally, I'd never seen much use in it, unless you were doing some sort of specialized work. I'm not particularly talented at brown magic, thank goodness, but some are. Zagor has his puppies, for instance, and Master Dunsellin was known to have a very fat white cat. But some magi specialize in brown magic to the extent that they can transfer their minds, more precisely extend their consciousness into the minds of their familiar through a permanent psychic connection. I've always considered that as much a liability as an advantage. The attachment between mage and familiar is so strong that it has been known for magi to go into comas if their familiars are injured or killed. The archmage Arnos II died the night his beloved hound was crushed by a carriage, for instance, unable to handle the sudden shock to his mind. Perhaps it's the healthy paranoia most war magi develop, but the idea of an enemy holding a knife to your kitty cat's throat and telling you to drop your sword or the familiar gets it just seems counterintuitive. Perhaps it was the sudden appearance of snowstone that quickened the effect. Westwood was well within the 2-mile radius of the spell, or perhaps it was Dara's natural talent expressing itself. We'll never know. But she was able to manage this fairly sophisticated feat of magic without a bit of training, or even much awareness. Brown magi were legends and stories to most folk, and their ways are odd even to other magi. Dara didn't let her own ignorance stop her. She continued training Frightful, using her mind, until she was able to fly him all over the valley, seeing it through his eyes. Indeed, she had first used the bird to practical effect by scouting Cowland's Pass for her father, though at the time she had let him think she was just a really good scout. So Dara's Frightful had retrieved my pipe by simply flying past all of the challenges and spells and trials to the top of Matten's Helm, all save for the final enchantment, the nasty bane warding I'd crafted. That was the tricky part, Dara explained, while we all listened to her in shock, because my spell was targeted at human minds, and the first few attempts she made had been confounded by it. Her mind was affected, even though the bird's was not. Once she realized the problem, however, she adeptly slipped out of contact with the bird, just long enough for it to retrieve the pipe, like its lure, its tiny mind completely unaffected by my spell. Once retrieved, Dara slipped back behind the bird's eyes and directed it back to its perch, where it delivered the prize into her hand while the other contestants were struggling past giggling riverfolk hurling rotten onions. Lenadara hadn't even left the commons. She told us this as she fed her beautiful bird, and I was perplexed into speechlessness. Once Bannermore confirmed that she had indeed paid her sixpence fee to enter the trials and was properly registered with the Coin Brothers, that left me in a quandary. There were fully trained war magi who were about to slay each other over this witchstone. If it became known that they had been bested by a girl only 2 months into her maiden moons, there would be violence. To be bested by a well-trained and well-prepared competitor was one thing. To be bested by a clever 13-year-old girl and a well-trained beast was something else again. "You just can't do it," Pentandra said, shaking her head, as we discussed the matter over lunch after dismissing Dara into her uncle's care. Time was pressing. We had to come up with a solution quickly. Things were getting tense. Tyndall had informed us that the second and third place winners had indeed dueled near the top of the summit after overcoming all of the other challenges, simply to establish which of them was the superior mage. When the front runner, a highly talented war mage named Jendaran the Trusty, if you're keeping score, finally overcame my final enchantment, only to find the rock empty, he nearly went mad with grief and rage. At first, he thought the contest had been a fraud, and he had demanded the Coin Brothers investigate. When he learned that someone had beat him to the prize, he was willing to listen, but he demanded to meet the man who had bested him. Jendaran might have been trusty, but he wasn't any more blessed by humility than any of my colleagues, and his pride was touched by the loss. Several of the other competitors who had been right behind Jendaran were also demanding to know who had won. It was a tense situation. I had agreed to hold off announcing the winner until we could settle the matter, and I had convened the High Magi present for luncheon in my campaign tent to discuss what to do. "You're right, there will be a riot," Planner said matter-of-factly. "Two people almost died from the spells on the trail, and fights broke out all over the mountain," Tyndall just told me. "Master Olmeg had to count a few contestants out." "You cannot give a witchstone to a stripling lass," Mavone agreed vehemently. "Not when there are so many worthy magi who competed. Jendaran, at least, is a proven war mage of good repute. He would gladly serve against the Gavani. With a witchstone, he'd be powerful. But this girl? She knows not the slightest cantrip. Her talent is just emerging. For all we know, she's just a sport." "Perhaps, but she did best the others at the contest. She did not violate the terms. You merely failed to provide terms that would keep someone from doing that," Bannermore observed, shaking his head. "We can't renege on the contest. The Coin Brethren took their oaths. They took bets," he pointed out. "If you award the stone to any but her, they may withdraw their sanction from Sevendor." "That would keep anyone from wagering in my domain, theoretically." My spell warden seemed scandalized about the prospect. He muttered to me under his breath, "At least she's one of your yeomen's daughters. Keep the stone in the family, as it were." "That's another consideration," Pentandra pointed out. "If her father is your vassal, then there are all sorts of trouble the magi out there can stir up if they feel slighted. The Coin Brethren will investigate any allegations of favoritism." "But does the girl have any talent beyond this trick with the bird?" Mavone asked. "I tested her myself," Pentandra assured him. "It was a preliminary test, and she's still developing, but there's a sizable talent within her. Enough to become a mage, perhaps, or at least a very powerful, specialized sport, if her Rajira doesn't develop completely. The stone would not be wasted." "That's a matter of perspective," Mavone said haughtily. "But she won," Bannermore insisted. "We can't ignore that." I thought about it long and hard as the others debated. I had interviewed the girl, and despite her shyness, she was possessed of a canny intelligence. While she couldn't read, she was willing to learn and plainly capable of mastering the art. And Penny was right. She did have significant talent. Indeed, she wasn't too much further along than I had been when I had been sent to the academy, and perhaps further along than Tyndall had been when I'd found him in that stable. But could I take the risk of bloodshed at the first magic fair by honouring my word to a child? Finally, after a lot of thought and 2 rounds of smoking my recently delivered pipe, that afternoon I reached my decision. I discussed it with my makeshift council in my tent while a crowd grew outside. She won the contest, I reasoned. She gets a stone. A lesser stone, the least of stones. Perhaps one of those which Mavone brought from Wenchar, but a stone nonetheless. Mavone and Sarakim did not look pleased. Jendaran didn't either. Jendaran was a big man. The kind of man you'd figure would make a good war mage. He was taller than me by 6 inches in his boots, and his shoulders were broad. His hair was plaited into 2 thick braids that hung down each side of his head, making him look very intimidating. He wore a long hauberk of silver chain, belted at the waist, and carried a thick hickory battle staff, shod in iron, as well as his mage blade. He was a handsome man, a bit older than me, and his face was crossed with scars from his active service. His gauntleted hands grasped the air over and over as he sought to control his emotions. Mavone was right. He would be an asset in the penumbra, or a positive hazard to my domain if he got pissed off. But in recompense for his outstanding performance, I am ruling that Jendaran the Trusty is also awarded a stone, the stone I'd originally intended as the prize, for he met and defeated every challenge put before him. But as he did not prevail in the contest, I am making this award conditional. He must enter the war as a member of one of the militant orders. The earnest young war magi had already assured me he'd like nothing better. That's why he had made his way to Sevendor in the first place. The Penumbra Lands provided the ideal place for a mage to use the limits of his power. But she shall get her stone, I continued. She earned it, and any mage who takes issue with her fair victory can discuss it with me personally. More, I shall grant her father a boon. I shall endeavour to teach her magic in accordance with her talent and intelligence, and make her a high mage, in fact, as well as in name.
Wouldn't that make her your apprentice?
Tyndall asked, a startled look on his face.
Your junior apprentice?
Rondell asked, grinning. He'd taken a lot of crap from Tyndall about being my junior apprentice in terms of service when Rondell was 6 months older than Tyndall. Actually, while she technically might be mine, I'd like to pair her with Olmig, Bannermore, even Zagor. See what she picks up. Then it was Rondell's turn to look alarmed.
Master, if she doesn't receive proper foundations in the basics of Imperial magic, then she'll not be able to pass her exams.
Who needs exams?
Tyndall said expansively. He had been bested by more war magi than he'd defeated, which should have been a little humbling. It hadn't seemed to have taken.
I'm as in favour of an Imperial-style education as anyone, I agreed. But Dara doesn't even know how to read yet.
The Westwood men don't value such skills. Woodlaw and herbalism, green magic and brown magic, those they would value. If she is to be trained, then let her be trained to keep and defend Sevendor.
But that's our job, pouted Tyndall.
You two are knights magi in your own right, I dismissed. You both need polishing, you both need tutoring, you both need practice, a lot of practice. But your deeds and errantry will be far from here. Hers will likely not be. Someone has to watch the hearth fires when you were at war. Having a fully trained Dare here, guarding Sevendor, should bring you some comfort when you're 500 leagues away, knee-deep in goblin guts.
You always paint such a vivid picture, Master,
Rondell said, looking queasy. The fight with Gimbald taught me something, I admitted. I can't be everywhere at once. I need good people who know their jobs. The best people, preferably, but people I can work with, which is why I need you two well-trained and out in the field. And I need folk like Bannermore and Olmeg and Zagor, and yes, little Dara, perhaps, watching out for our interests here at home. That noble prospect did little to mollify them. They weren't the only ones. When I announced my decision to the fair at large, there was nearly a riot again. I had to assert my authority with a dramatic thunderclap spell to regain order. Not only were the wagerers angry at the surprise outcome, but so were many of the magi. Bannermore spoke with them repeatedly, and even had Jendaran come forth and agreed that he had been bested by a stripling sport. I had the two meet briefly before I'd made my decision. Dara was intimidated by the mage, but not so much she was going to give up her claim to the prize. He even went so far as to praise Dara's ingenuity and courage. I don't think he would have done if we hadn't promised him a witchstone. That ended the grumbling and began the celebration. I had the fare pay for a couple of hogsheads of ale to be freely distributed on the commons that evening. Yeoman Cayman was so proud of his youngest daughter, he composed a rustic poem in praise of her at the banquet in her honour that night. The other Westwood men were likewise proud of their kin, and any suggestion that perhaps her stone should be taken from her by force, as was murmured a few times, was met with stern looks from steel-grey eyes that promised a contentious end to such a cause. Mostly they consoled themselves with drink and the excitement of the fair. Though a few hotheads thought that they were more than a match for a mere girl, Bannermore and his wardens were able to intervene before anyone did anything stupid. I figured that the hangovers the next morning would end any talk of retribution. Now that Jendaran had his stone and was eagerly practicing with it, Dara's dramatic win would slowly fade in importance, likely by the next morning. Unfortunately, the next morning, Lenadara wasn't the name on everyone's lips. That honour went to Castle Cambrian. Castle Cambrian was one of the older baronial castles in Gilmora, one of the stately old manors that fecund part of the Riverlands is famous for. More residence than fortress, Castle Cambrian hadn't seen battle in almost a century. It was along the Cotton Road, and had its own trade fair every year. But it was more a glorified toll booth than a proper fortress. It had recently found new life as the headquarters and forward command post of Knight Commander Telemann. He was commanding the magical defence of Barrowbell, in conjunction with some local lords, and he found the place comfortable and well located. He had been intercepting any large bands that had wandered south since he'd returned from the coronation. Since the dragons had attacked the Gilmoran garrisons, the defence of the region had turned piecemeal. Goblin bands wandered the countryside, burning and looting and enslaving. They were avoiding larger castles and towns, but had turned the rural landscape into a churning hell of burned-out cots and horrific displays of torture and execution. Telemann's men had been chasing the smaller bands for weeks, but hadn't been able to bring them to a decisive battle. Instead, the war had turned into a raid and counter-raid war of attrition, which we were losing. Even with the extensive peasantry of the Gilmoran baronies armed, individual encounters with the Givani had gone mostly in their favour, and every minor loss had added up to thousands of casualties. The recent arrival of Count Margiaf and 1,000 mercenary horse under the banner of the new king was the first relief that Telemann had seen in weeks. It should have been the reinforcements that turned the tide. Margiaf was one of Count Sago's lieutenants, a good and sturdy commander and veteran of the Farisian campaign, by all accounts. When his column was suddenly set upon by 5 times their number, soon after they disembarked their barges, the good count ordered a retreat at full speed toward the castle. A sortie from the castle came out to help defend the mercenaries from the Givani, but fresh goblin legions from the north interceded and drove both parties back to Cambrian, where they surrounded the castle. Almost half of Telemann's forces were dispatched to the north to shore up the weakened defences there, so there was little hope of relief against the forces that had come so quickly against his headquarters. The dead god had made the lands around Castle Cambrian a sea of seething evil. Telemann was trapped, besieged, with little hope of rescue. I could empathize. That's how the siege of Beauval had felt. He had spent all night calling everyone he could, beginning with myself, for assistance. He wasn't being a coward, either. He was being a good commander. Telemann has twice as much combat experience as I do. He had a good defensible position at Cambrian, over 5,000 troops within its walls, 6,000 now, and good supply, for a while. Telemann's defensive plan had been to conserve his strength at Cambrian, not get lured away too far, and strike out at any force that tried to pass by to assail the city. There were smaller castles closer to the city, and there was a rough line of defenders across the entire Mesopotamian area. but Cambrian was the main force opposing organized aggression against Barrowbell. Considering the decentralized nature of the Gavanni advance through Gilmora, that had seemed a prudent measure at the time. None of the bands that were causing such havoc in the Riverlands would have been large enough to challenge Cambrian. But with Count Margiaf's arrival, several bands had coalesced very quickly into a larger army to give chase, a lot more quickly than Telamon had figured. His intelligence had told him there were no more than 4,000 Gavanni in the immediate region, but more than 10,000 had suddenly converged on Cambrian Castle, and more were arriving every hour. The implication of the sudden siege was clear. Telamon was unlikely to break the siege quickly from within, and it would keep his forces pinned down completely enough to allow Barrowbell to be assaulted. Scrying had shown that there were more Gavanni, a lot more, than had been originally accounted for in the invasion of Gilmora. Worse, getting pinned up in the castle made Telamon, Margiaf, and everyone else at Cambrian Castle dragon bait. That many men in one place was poor strategy, but it was either stay in the castle and wait for the dragons, or go out and try to hack their way through the legions of goblins surrounding them. Neither prospect seemed to promise survival, much less victory. Telamon's war magi, the doughty Horkan Order, was doing their best to discomfit the enemy, but there were plenty of shamans present to defend against them, and they were defending more effectively now, Telamon's dispatches had demonstrated. If Cambrian Castle fell, there would be no impediment to the goblins breaking through the northern lines in greater force and assailing the city of Barrowbell. If Barrowbell fell, then the economic power of the Gilmoran baronies would be lost forever, not to mention tens of thousands of human lives. Thousands had fled the city downriver, but thousands more had stayed because they were too poor or too invested to flee. There were two pieces of arguably good news. There were enough war magi and troops at Barrowbell to at least slow the legions down before they pillaged the city. That might give King Rad and the additional 30,000 troops he'd called from the central Riverlands the chance to arrive in time to avenge them. Already there were two more units of mercenaries in the king's pay working their way upriver to strengthen Barrowbell's defences, and they might arrive within the week. But they were light cavalry, and too few to break the siege at Cambrian Castle. The other piece of good news was that the dead god was either not using his dragons as effectively as he could, or he was having difficulty deploying them. They couldn't be easy to handle, we figured. That was small comfort at the moment, but for our sake I was hoping they were feeling particularly defiant for a while. That still wouldn't help the basic situation. There were more of them than there were of us, and we weren't in the right places. I just don't see another way, Telamon told me, mind to mind, in our third conference of the morning. The southern Gilmoran fiefs have raised another 10,000 or more, peasant levies mostly, but it will take them weeks to march upriver, and far too long even if they arrive by boat, even with high magi urging their barges along. But I just learned that there's a legion headed towards Sicary Castle, and their captain has elected to defeat them before even heading upriver. We're trapped. Unless someone can find an army to relieve us, we're going to be in here until the dragons come. Don't worry about the dragons, I told him with false confidence. I'm working on something right now, with some of the artifacts the Alka Alon gave us at the coronation. I'm working closely with them now, too. Perhaps not quite the truth, exactly, if you held it up to the light and looked too hard, but it was enough. That's encouraging, Telamon replied hopefully. Supposedly they faced dragons themselves in their ancient wars. Maybe those arboreal buggers can figure out some way to transport a couple of thousand troops halfway across the duchy. That would be convenient, I said automatically, but it's the threat of dragons I'm concerned with. Not as concerned as I, at the moment, Telamon responded. We're weathering the siege, and it isn't nearly as bad as Bovall Castle, but it's pretty bad. Understood. I'll do what I can, I promised. The problem was, there wasn't a whole hell of a lot I could do. Maybe the king? I called to Master Harterian, the new court mage, as soon as I could. He wasn't very helpful either. His Majesty is aware of the situation,
He assured me, mind to mind, he is doing his damnedest to get more troops into Gilmora as it is, but there really isn't anything he can do to hurry things up.
What about mercenaries?
What mercenaries? Artarian complained. They've suddenly found pressing engagements elsewhere, with a few exceptions. Most of them had been engaged 2 months ago or more, for certain rebellious counts in the coastal region of Ulshar, who are about as happy as Merwin is about His Majesty's coronation. Every major company has been contracted at this point. Count Sager had to put the units he did send together piecemeal, and some wouldn't take service with the Crown anyway, for personal reasons. He admitted,
"Gods damn them,"
I said, losing control for just a moment. "Don't they know there's a war on?" "That's why they took service with the Counts," Artarian confided. "Fighting Gervani leaves little room for looting. There are plenty of mercenaries in central Castal and Wenshar now, and even some companies looking for work in Rhaemir. The big dynastic wars there have been quieted by the coronation, with the noble houses suing for peace in hopes of appeasing the new monarch. But it would take 3 weeks or more to get them from central Rhaemir down the river to sea, and thence to Castal. The Wenshari would likely make better time overland, but either way, it would be autumn before they arrived at Barrowbell." I thanked the court wizard and ended the spell. Then I cursed a blue streak, to the point where the mage light that indicated my residence above Sevendor Castle started pulsing and spurting sparks, changing hue and size. Luckily, the attendees of the magic fair thought it was part of the entertainment. In the sudden and constant fog of the military emergency, I'd almost forgotten I had guests. The fair was still going on. I thought in my lab for almost an hour, brooding over the situation. I had to help Talaman. Somehow. He was too good a man and too good a commander to let down. He needed more men, an entire army of them, but I didn't see much use trying to find troops where there weren't any. But maybe I could discourage the possibility of dragons. The thoughtful knife the Alca-Alon had given to us was legendary for its sharpness and power, I reasoned. I needed to know if it would penetrate dragon scale, and there was only one place that could answer that question. I closed my eyes, tapped into my sphere, and summoned the glyph that Lady Varen had given me to speak with her, mind to mind. I wasn't sure if the Alka could do this naturally or with a spell, but slipping into the rapport was effortless.
"Yes, Mage Lord," came the cordial response.
"Lady Varen, I need your help. The kingdom needs your help, actually. Is there any way for you to find the time to drop by? Perhaps teach us how to use the thoughtful knife. We have a crisis brewing."
"How can I be of assistance, Mage Lord?" Lady Varen asked, using her voice.
I opened up my eyes and blinked. There she was in my lab, in her human tall form.
"How do you do that?" I gasped. "It's actually not a difficult spell," she admitted with a slight smile,
the first time I had seen her act less than formally.
"It merely requires a prodigious amount of energy and a detailed knowledge of higher magics. The proximity of the snowstone makes it much easier," she admitted.
"Doing magic around snowstone in general is much less effort. Ordinarily, I would not consider using such spells lightly, but your summons seemed urgent."
"I've noticed. And yes, it is urgent. We have a military crisis. The Gervani have invested a strategic castle in Gilmora. They are surrounded, but secure for the moment. But they're also a ripe target for one of the dead god's dragons. I need a way to combat them. And if the legends about the thoughtful knife are true..."
"They are," Lady Varen agreed gravely. "But it is not an easy weapon to master," she warned.
"Few are, once you get beyond sharp sticks," I agreed. "But I don't have time to indulge in a thorough study. I've got dragons that could show up at any time."
I took the thoughtful knife out of its box and placed it on my workbench.
"Now, how does this work?"
She sighed.
"There is not time, then, to give you an extensive lesson." She caressed the back of the gleaming white blade, and a small jewel came off in her hand. She handed it to me. "Let us see your affinity with the knife."
I took the jewel, and as my hand closed around it, my consciousness shrank and moved, and I suddenly was the knife. I suppressed the urge to vomit as the world spun around me and my subconscious panicked. Eventually I got my bearings, but riding the thoughtful knife is akin to riding a speeding stallion, while standing up in the saddle and balancing a feather on your nose. For the next 2 hours, Lady Varen showed me how to activate the knife, carefully insert my focused attention within its magical matrix, and make it float across the floor. It was odd seeing things through the knife's perspective, and it took me almost an hour to get my bearings well enough to make it fly at any speed. The sensation of flying the knife was disconcerting. Human beings are not meant to fly, and our brains have a hard time making the adjustment. Seeing the world from above was a heady but terrifying experience. Finally, when I had demonstrated I could establish basic control over the artifact, Lady Varen let me take the knife outside, where I carefully flew it around my white castle. Only a few noticed enough to point at it, but they weren't alarmed. By this time my people were pretty used to strange happenings emitting from the spellmonger's tower. Then I lost control, and the thing tumbled from the sky. I just couldn't keep my orientation from that perspective. Just when I thought I had it, an attack of vertigo undermined my bearings and it fell. When it hit the castle wall, the edge stuck 4 inches into the white stone.
"I just can't do it. Not without a lot more practice," I said apologetically as I wiped the copious beads of sweat off my forehead. "I can't seem to manage the perspective from above. Not everyone is endowed with the ability to move their consciousness easily," she soothed. I could tell she was disappointed. I had barely gotten it in the air. "Nor is everyone used to flying. Indeed, I know a few humans who are." That took me aback, because I actually did know a human who was, in a fashion, used to flight. Linadara. The girl was learning to bond with her witchstone under the guidance of Tyndall and Rondal, who seemed both annoyed and pleased at the task of teaching the 13-year-old. I summoned all three of them to my lab that moment, and they came quickly. Both of my apprentices wanted to watch, and though they were cowed by the presence of Lady Varen, they were both mesmerized by watching Dara quickly overcome the difficulties I had faced in mastering the thoughtful knife. Within minutes, the knife was sailing merrily around the castle with beauty and deadly promise. "She seems to be naturally talented," Lady Varen conceded, pleased. "She has wit and valor, it seems. Should she master the knife, it is possible that it could be employed against a dragon. If applied with sufficient force and dexterity, there is a possibility that the knife could be effective against Dragon-eyed." "Let us hope it can be," I sighed wearily. "It may be our only hope. If I can find some way to transport Dara and myself all the way to Barrowbell in the next few days, we may arrive before the dead god sends a worm."
"But, Mage Lord," Lady Varen said gently, "I would be happy to transport you and the girl, and any others you need. As I said, with Snowstone proximate, it is a far simpler enchantment."
"That's quite noble of you," I said, unsure about how I felt about being transported. "But isn't that too long a distance?" She smiled indulgently, and perhaps a little condescendingly.
"Mage Lord, distance matters not. My kindred have walked this world for thousands of years. Mighty empires have risen and fallen. Great cities were built and fell to ruin. But magic? Magic persists. Wherever the Alka Alon have established a transport point in the past, I can send you."
That was encouraging and exceedingly useful. If only... Telemann's words came back to my mind. "Maybe those arboreal buggers can figure out some way to transport a couple of thousand troops halfway across the duchy." That got me thinking, and plotting, and then a whole new plan evolved.
"Lady Varen," I said carefully, "just how many of us could you transport?"